Hello and welcome to the Peace Alliance Hope Story Circles, and welcome to Peace On, your source for inspiring conversations and information from thought leaders across the spectrum on topics related to the strategies of building peace, fostering nonviolence, and creating a world that thrives, shifting our understanding toward empathy, compassion, and connection. My name is Terry Mason. I'm on the board of the Peace Alliance, and I'm joined today to co-facilitate the Hope Story Circle, Liz Gannon-Graydon, who is also on our board, and Yelena Popovich, who is our Teaching Peace in Schools lead. And we have a special guest today. Her name is Dee Shanti, and she is our new Managing Director of the Peace Alliance. And we are so excited to have you be part of the organization and be part of the Hope Story Circle today and be our guest speaker. If you could unmute yourself, and we can chat just a bit before we get started.
Sure. Hi, everybody. Thank you all for having me. Glad to see all these wonderful faces.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? Yeah. So not only joining our group as our new managing director, you have a book coming out soon.
Yes, I do. Very excited. It is in pre-printing right now, so I haven't actually held it physically in my hand yet, but it's called Under the Radar, When Truth Hides in Plain Sight, and it is my memoir, and it's been, 2 years of putting this together, and I'm really excited about it coming out.
Oh, I can imagine this. Creating a book is a huge endeavor, so I admire your completion of that.
It's like giving birth.
Yeah, it really is. Truly, only it takes longer than 9 months.
So. Yes.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. Congratulations for that.
Thank you.
So we'll get started. If we could please ask Yelena to lead us in a meditation, and then she will hand directly off to you, Dee.
Thank you. Wonderful. Welcome, Dee. Welcome, everyone. So good to see you all here. And for those of you that are listening on the podcast, welcome to our space. We're just going to take a moment to center ourselves into this moment. So whatever that means to you, however you want to be in this moment, that will allow you to just take a moment to notice what is the internal weather? What is the internal weather inside of you? What's going on? Checking in with the earth, with the surface you are sitting on, with your breath. Attuning perhaps to the sounds that are around you. Or anchoring your attention to the sensation of the breath. Or perhaps just anchoring your soles of the feet to the earth and staying with that connection for a moment. Just choose your own adventure of how you wanna check in. Check in what is alive for you in this moment. Mm-hmm. Check in with your truth. Any of the thoughts of the past or the future just, you know, come upon you, just allow them, notice them and come back to anchoring to this moment. And perhaps in the few last moments of this check-in, just check in with your intention for listening to this story, opening to connection, listening. Your greatest gifts, your presence and time. Thank you all for being here today. And with that, I welcome Dee.
Thank you. Well, good day to everyone. I have to come out of that space now to tell my story. I want to say thank you to Terry and Yelena and Liz for inviting me to share my story with you all today. And I want to say thank you to everyone for being in community with me. I want to acknowledge that there might be folks on this call that did not grow up in the United States or who are not living in the US right now. And I also want to acknowledge that not everyone on this call might identify as white. So the story that I'm telling today is not unique to the United States, but it is specific to growing up here as a white person in this country. So just wanted to share that my framework will reflect that perspective. I grew up in a small segregated town in North Carolina, very, very white. And I was very oblivious to that whiteness. The only Black people I had connection with worked for my family. And in recent years, I've come to realize how little I knew about them, how little I knew the details of their stories. And I've had to do some reflection around that. I came from very deeply embedded ancestors in white supremacy and the development of white supremacy in this country. Two of my most notable ancestors I wanted to just bring into the dialogue today as kind of my qualifiers for discussing this. The first is my great-great-grandfather, General Robert Hoke, who was Robert E. Lee's right-hand man. He was the Confederate general. And he was slated to take over for Lee if Lee was ever killed on the battlefield. as the general of the, or commander of the Confederate Army. He had to, after the war, he did survive the war, and after the war, he had to actually travel in person to Washington, D.C. to be pardoned by President Lincoln, because he was such a high-ranked officer. He had to be pardoned so that he could be readmitted as a citizen of the United States, because he chose to secede from that country in being a part of the Confederacy. And the second ancestor that I wanted to bring in is my great-grandfather. Both of these gentlemen are on my father's side. His name was Judge Henry Grady. He was a judge, a sitting judge, and in Wilson, North Carolina. And he was also the Grand Dragon of the KKK in North Carolina. Oddly enough, I have a copy of his resignation letter from that organization in 1927. They wanted him to advance some sort of legislation, and he wasn't down with that, and they asked him to resign. It's a very interesting letter to read. So I wanted to offer this, you know, when I have conversations with outwardly white supremacists here in Charleston, they often like to say that I don't qualify to have that dialogue with them because they don't, it's not my history, it's not my heritage, especially because I do not have a Southern accent, even though I grew up in North Carolina. So these two gentlemen are only two of my qualifiers for those dialogues, so that they understand that I do come from the same heritage they come from. I don't believe in coincidences. And so, you know, I believe that there's a reason I ended up in Charleston a little over 20 years ago, Charleston, South Carolina. This is the town where over 40% of kidnapped Africans were brought into the United States to be enslaved. They came in at a place called Gadsden's Wharf. And this is the town where the first shot of the Civil War was fired. So I believe there's a reason why I am here. But for the first 16 years that I lived in what I call now Confederate Disneyland, that's not, I didn't make that up, but it to me, it very rightly identifies this city. For the first 16 years I lived here, I was oblivious to the racial inequity that was all around me. I was a good person. I was loving to the people around me. I even served as the South Carolina State Coordinator for the Peace Alliance in the early 2000s, trying to make the world a more peaceful place. And at the same time, I was still oblivious to the racial inequities that surrounded me in this city. Until June 17th, 2015, when a 21-year-old white young man was welcomed into a Bible study in the basement of Mother Emanuel AME Church here in Charleston. He sat down with the 10 parishioners in that room to pray and prayed with them for an hour. Then he stood up and began firing on them with his gun that he had brought in with him. He intentionally left one of those parishioners alive, and he told her why. He told her that he wanted her to tell the tale, and that's why he left her alive. That was the moment that I began my awakening into my whiteness. But I also need to say out loud that just 2 months before that, on April 4th, 2015, a Black man named Walter Scott was shot 6 times in the back as he ran away from a white police officer after a traffic stop for a broken taillight in Charleston. And that event did not wake me up. That was just 2 months before. I think I heard about it in the news, but it did not resonate with me at all at the time. And it's important that I make that distinction, because even in my journey of being a good white woman, loving people and trying to do all the right things, I did not get enraged when Walter Scott was murdered. I was shocked into awareness by the massacre at Mother Emanuel, and I was 47 years old and had lived, you know, that long being oblivious to what was going on around me. I keep telling people when they ask me if I'm going to stay in Charleston, my daughter's grown and flown and I'm footloose. I could live anywhere. I keep telling people that Charleston's not done with me yet. There's a reason I'm here. I don't know exactly what my journey still needs to be in this town. But every time when I consider moving away, I choose to stay. And I think there's a reason for that. I could easily move to a predominantly white city and can live a very comfortable existence, never noticing again that I support, uphold, and benefit from white supremacy every day. Or I could stay in Charleston and still live a comfortable existence right here, with racial injustice happening everywhere. Awakening to whiteness, my whiteness, is a choice that I make every day. And I know that I can walk into any predominantly white space and everyone around me will assimilate me into their ideology. I could just disappear into the masses. But now that I see it, I can't turn away. It's just not within me. I'm not telling this story for kudos or accolades or any of that. Make no mistake, I was very, very late to the show. I still have a lot of work to do. My hope for the white folks on this call that are listening, my hope is that you realize that it's never too late to start this journey. It's never too late to wake up. It's never too late to do your own deep dive into the indoctrination, especially if you grew up in this country, that started with your first breath. It doesn't really matter if your parents never uttered the N-word. It doesn't really matter if you were taught to love everybody regardless of how different they might have looked from you. White supremacy is in every thread of the fabric of this country, and we were all deeply indoctrinated into it. It's not a quick journey. We're never gonna graduate. I'm never gonna get a certificate that says, guess what? You've graduated, you're not racist anymore. I tend to look at it as a spectrum. We white people tend to be taught that it's a good, bad binary, that you're bad if you're a racist and you're good if you're not. But I've come to learn that it's a spectrum and everybody lands on that spectrum in a different place, with one end of that spectrum being hood wearing and cross burning, what we typically think of as racist people. And the other end of that spectrum being a white person who actively chooses to make anti-racist choices every moment of every day, in every dialogue with family, with friends, with loved ones, with strangers, and standing up every time we hear microaggressions or overt aggressions toward Black and people, Indigenous people of color. I wanna make a suggestion to those of you who might be interested in doing your own deep dive or starting. There's an author named Dr. Layla F. Saad. Her last name is spelled S-A-A-D. She's a Black woman, was raised, I believe, in the United Kingdom, and she now lives in the country of Qatar. And she wrote a book called Me and My White Supremacy. And it's a workbook. It's a journaling journey to unpack your own white supremacy within you, all those little blind spots that you might have that you're unaware of, that were taught to you over the course of your lifetime. She talks to us about not necessarily becoming better white people, although that's important. She charges us with the idea of becoming better ancestors. And I had to reflect on that for a while because I wasn't sure what that meant when I first read it. What I've come to understand is the idea that it's not just about me becoming a better person for this lifetime. It's about what might happen 2 and 3 and 4 generations later when my descendants are on ancestry.com or whatever the format is of the day, and they're looking into my life and they're saying, and they're discovering whether or not I was a good ancestor. What was my journey? What things did I do? How did I affect change in this country to make it a better place for them generations later? So I just want to leave you all with that idea because it really, really resonated with me when I read that in her book. It's taken 400 years to get where we are. It's not going to happen overnight, but it is worth the journey. It's worth starting it. It's worth talking to your children. It's worth talking to your grandchildren. If systemic racism could be dismantled by Black people, it would have been done a long time ago. White people created this. It is a function of what we created, and it's our job to dismantle it and to clean it up. It begins with us, and we have to find the courage to take that step, that first step, and then the next step, and then the next step, to keep moving through and try to affect the real change that we want to see that's going to change this country. And I believe it will change the world. I want to leave you all with a poem that I wrote. It was several months ago. I believe it was not long after George Floyd was murdered. And on that particular day, I'd had a difficult conversation with a Black activist woman friend that I have here in Charleston named Tamika Gadsden. I consider her an accountability partner for me. She keeps me in check, and she will check me if I overstep or I say the wrong thing or I ask her for labor that she is not willing to give. And I love her for that, and I cherish her for that. This particular day, she had checked me on something that I had done that was rooted in white supremacy. And I was processing that and wrote this poem as I processed that situation. So I'm gonna read it to you and then close for the day. It's entitled 400 Years in 24 Hours. In 24 hours, the world can spin in ways one could never see coming. I demanded labor of a Black woman who graciously declined with her teeth tightly clenched against my white supremacy. I witnessed the census of 1840 showing the 16 souls enslaved by my great-great-grandfather, their names unrecorded, lost on the whispers of time. I watched for 8 minutes and 46 seconds as the life drained away from a Black man under the knee of a white man with a license to kill. I worked to organize a gathering of women in service to the voices my heart compels me to amplify. I watched my forever president as a tear fell to his cheek while he spoke of lynching and chains and bondage of his ancestors, perpetrated by my own. I opened my heart to the first Black woman nominated for the second chair, speaking of justice and family and hope. What will I say when asked, what did I do to change the world? What will I pledge, knowing the crimes of my forefathers, knowing atonement might never heal the wounds their lashes rendered? In 24 hours, I've seen my legacy of horror and shame reflected in my eyes. In 24 hours, I've been given tasks that might lead to redemption. In 24 hours, I've seen 400 years of history, and I know I'm not even close to the edge of what's possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Dee. We do have an inquiry that we spoke about yesterday. Liz, I wonder if you'd like to frame the inquiry for the breakout sessions.
Yeah, I'll start. And then Yelena, if you want to add something, please join in. I was really moved when Dee was framing her story for us last night about how brave it was for her not only to tell this story, but kind of admit how late she came to the game. And I wondered if, as we move into the inquiry, it might be for each of us to reflect on, is there a moment, right? Is there a moment where you can remember being aware of the I'm trying to think of how to phrase it, right? I always talk about, right, the original sin. That's the language I sometimes use of race, especially in America, although, it, you know, there are certainly issues elsewhere. Is there a moment you can picture in your own life, whether very young or very recently? You know, when we started these Hope Story Circles, we started just trying to reach out to one another in this time of COVID. And then it got convulsed, right, as the nation did and the world in many ways, by the murder of George Floyd, at, you know, which Dee referenced. And I'm sure that was a reckoning for some people, but what we'd ask you to bring into the small groups is, can you remember a specific moment in your own life when you became aware of what race meant in America? Okay. Did you want to add anything, Yelena?
I just want to add a moment of reflection, actually, Liz. Thank and you. Just attuning to what the feeling in the body as Dee was talking and reading a poem and noticing if there is any discomfort, anger, whatever is present, just kind of attuning to what is happening within you as you were hearing Dee's story. That's the thing that I would add.
Thank you for that, Yelena.
Okay, we're going to move into breakout rooms. I'm going to pause the recording and then we'll be back in about 15 minutes. All right, welcome back, everyone. So who would like to share what's alive for you after the time in your breakout rooms? You can raise your hand or just unmute yourself and speak. Is he Steve?
Yeah, hi. Nice to see you all. So I hope I can do justice to the two ladies who I was in the breakout room with. So they grew up in areas where they didn't have a lot of like contact with African Americans. It was kind of not part of the experience. And so I think that was an issue as they began to become more and more aware. They became aware, like with Martin Luther King and that whole civil rights movement began to awaken people to the idea of civil rights. And I think that's, which is very common, you know. I, on the other hand, I think some of you may know that I was raised by racists. And I heard the N-word before I could speak English from my grandfather's knee, literally, and listened to long diatribes about how awful people of color were, but using the N-word like constantly. So that's just a different thing. And I grew up in a segregated society. I think my youngest memory, when I first learned to read, like at like 5-6 years old, walking into a restaurant with a sign over the door that said whites only. And I remember that. It's, that place is now a Chinese restaurant. So karma kind of comes around. And so that was kind of our discussion about how those difficulties, but also we talked a little bit about the challenges in understanding human relationships, because, you know, it's, for instance, it's okay not to be unhappy with someone or not like someone and not be racist. I mean, it's just human relationships. They're good, bad people everywhere. People have their issues. In particular, one of the ladies mentioned people having chips on their shoulder maybe in school. And then I'm, you know, so I don't mind talking about myself. You know, I remembered having taught in the inner city kids, things like mothers would not send their kids to school in the morning because for fear of the kids going out in the dark and being assaulted. And so how kids in the inner city had to grow up in a very different environment. And so that naturally changes people. It's just different than some kids growing up in a farm town in the suburbs or something. It's just different. That's it.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you. Who else would like to share? I can't see everyone on one screen at the time.
But yeah, like I'm scanning as well.
Feel free to unmute yourself.
Lois? Yes, hi, thank you.
Lois, and then David.
Okay, thank you. In our group, we all had, the three of us each had a very different background and different levels of awareness at different points in our life. It seemed like one thing that we all agreed on was that right now we realize that there's always more to learn and more awareness that can happen within oneself. But one thing that came into our conversation was experiencing, you know, as a white person being in an environment where we as white are being, you know, the discriminated against. And my sense is that perhaps a lot of white people may not have had that kind of an experience and may not be aware that that could happen to them. But it does bring, at least I know in my experience of having had that happen in my life, it just brought a whole nother level of awareness to me that, okay, I'm in this situation. I'm not going to be here always, but for right now, I'm in this situation where it's going on. But someone that's got, you know, skin of color, you know, black skin, brown skin, they've got it 24/7. And that, I find it really sad, very sad. I mean, it angers me, but beneath that anger, there's just this deep sadness that about how human beings can be so non-compassionate to each other at times. Thank you.
Thank you, Lois. David?
Yeah, what's alive for me is outrage that we as a species tend to get upset, talk about, maybe even accept a situation, but then don't take action. We don't walk the talk. A lot of talk. I'm really tired of talk.
Yeah. Thank you, David. Linda, did you want to speak?
I did. We had a real breadth of experiences in our group. We had a wide range of life experience in our group. And at different times for each of us, we found an awakening. And then ideally, you know, I think all of us felt like we've come to a place where we're continuing to learn. Like Lois said, continuing to learn and grow. But I think that I'm going to actually ask Angie if she would share her thoughts with us, because they were so beautiful and succinct about our learned behaviors. Angie, would you do that?
Okay. I think you could have done that though, Linda. But basically what I said, I can't say it the exact same way, is that we all have been taught these things. We all learn them. And we all support them because we do them, whether we are white or not. And we do them because we really want peace. We don't like confrontation. It has to be forced upon us by environment or experience. And so as Black people or Latino people or immigrants that come to this country, they adapt to our cultural ways and our laws because that is the peace line. They're not doing it anything that is racist or biased or discriminatory out of malice. It is out of peace and trying to be a part of the norm. And this is what we're faced with. And also I mentioned I'm worried about the intra-racism because of having learned racism that goes from thousands of years of history, because Black Americans were not the first slaves in the history of the world, but we learned these behaviors, and with them comes ethnic and gender prejudices, so that you have Latinos who don't like Blacks who don't like Latinos, and people who don't like Jewish people, and people who don't like, when this country was founded, it was basically anti-Catholic. We have all of these things that we have to all work on. So the prejudice is not, the racism is not within one root place. The cause of it has a history, but to solve it is something we all have to do. I hope I didn't say too much, Linda.
I probably just have time for one more share.
Can I just say something?
Yes.
It's Annette.
Yes, hi, Annette.
Thank you. I was in the group with Lois Ann, and I appreciate what she was just saying. And to piggyback off that, I wanted to mention in our group, and I didn't get to that, while I'm so grateful for this awakening that I'm having and this education that I'm getting, because I have so much yet to learn, because my pigmentation is the way it is, I could always get lazy and take a break, not do anything about it, not fight for others' rights or civil rights and equality if I don't want to, because it's not my daily struggle. And that is something I have to constantly remind myself, that I can't get lazy. Just because I don't see it being reported on the news so much doesn't mean that it's gone and resolved, and I could go back to sharing photos on Instagram of my meal, you know? Like, I have to constantly remember that I am responsible as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Annette.
You're welcome.
Can I share something real fast?
Very quickly, Bonnie, please.
Okay. Months ago, you guys were hearing me talk about the United States Institute of Peace creating an award for women on peace building, and that they gave their first award. The nominations for next year's award has opened. You have until February 2nd, and this is around the world for to enter women to win that award. I was trying to get the link, didn't get it fast enough, but I've got a link that you can find the link from, and I'll put in the chat. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. Dee, did you want to have one closing comment before we?
Thank you. Just a clarification. Thank you. First of all, thank you to everyone sharing. And it sounds like the dialogues in the breakout rooms were very rich. Just a bit of a thought to take away, that white people can be treated unfairly, but we will never be. We will never be the recipients of racism. That's a distinction that I think is really important for white people to understand, because racism is a construct, and it, you know, I will never be stopped from getting a loan. I will never be redlined into an area. I will never be at risk for being shot at a traffic stop because
it's
of the
color. So of my foolish.
Face. That important differences. And then the other piece is just to remember that as white people, we always need to stay in our lane. That yes, discrimination exists in other groups, and Black and Indigenous people of color do feel discrimination and feel feelings towards other groups, but we need to stay in our lane and focus on what whiteness ends up doing to others. So just thank you for that opportunity to say that out loud.
Thank you, Dee. I'm putting a few links in the chat before we close the call. This call, the Hope Story Circles, are hosted by the Peace Alliance, which is at peacealliance.org, and the Peace Alliance empowers civic action toward a culture of peace. All of these calls are at our Peace On podcast channel, which you can find. Also, we have an initiative called the Blueprint for Peace. It's a one click to encourage all of your elected officials, both state and federal, to support policy behind peace building and violence reduction. We also are a small nonprofit. We appreciate donations of any size, and our donation link is there. And we also, Andy's putting in for the Department of Peacebuilding. That is one of our key initiatives. You can find that on the homepage or our website. And also, just to let you know, beginning in January, we're going to shift from weekly Hope Story Circles to twice a month, the second and fourth Saturday of every month. We'll send out the notices on Thursday and Saturday as we have been. It will be a different Zoom link. So just be aware of that. We look forward to seeing you in the new year. So we're setting you off with warm holiday wishes. We will not see you again until January 9th. So Liz, do you want to wrap it up for us?
I do. I'm going to try to do this very quickly. I want to thank Dee for her story and, you know, Yelena and Terry for co-hosting. And what came up for me is, you know, how different all of our journeys are. And some of you may know, I was raised by here in New York on Long Island, which is one of the most segregated places in our country. And I was raised by a father who was a civil rights activist and a college professor in the 60s. But then he moved us to Levittown, Long Island, which was the place we could afford a house. You know, it was an inexpensive place to live. And my first memory of the world was the assassination of Martin Luther King, because I didn't understand it, right? I didn't understand it. And it was the first time I watched my father cry while watching television. And right around that same time, our neighbors who adopted a little African-American boy, you know, at the time, that same year that King and Bobby were killed, the year I was five, they had a cross burned on their lawn and they had to flee our neighborhood. And I watched my father again cry standing at the door. We could see the flames from our block. And so very early, I tried to grapple with, you know, things Dee was talking about. And from the age of 9 to 12, I tried to immerse myself in everything my dad was teaching and reading. So at the age of 9, I think I read Soul on Ice and Down These Mean Streets and books that I was probably too young to have read. But I became very clear that my life was very different than other people, kind of. But as Annette said, and as Dee said, that I want to point out, if you had told me when I was five that 50 years later, when I was raising my children, these would still be issues, I was so sure that with King and with all the work that was being done, we were so close to getting this right. And I want to come full circle to what Dee said about being a good ancestor. I don't want to leave this work for my children and children's children. But to name what Annette said, there's a term I learned from studying and being involved in a small way in the anti-apartheid movement. And it's a term that says, a luta continua. I believe it's Portuguese, right? The struggle continues. You can't ever think the work is done and you've moved on and here we are, right? So wherever you are in your journey and however you entered the journey, I'm thankful for Dee for waking us, but with the awareness that a luta continua and we can never think we've made it and go home. So I wish you a beautiful, peaceful couple of weeks. And I'm thankful for all we've done in this kind of crazy, difficult year. And I look forward to what we'll continue to birth together in the new year. So thank you, everyone. And I'll see you. We'll see you on the 9th.
Feel free to unmute yourself to say goodbye.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
A peaceful new year. Thank you for joining us today at Peace On. We hope that it inspires you to engage in dialogue in your larger community. Peace On is brought to you by the Peace Alliance, found at peacealliance.org.